This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
This poem is a monologue by one of the characters in this book. There are five teenage girls who often give monologues and commercials and interviews, and this one's a monologue from Jocelyn. Jocelyn is standing in a school cafeteria. The cafeteria is empty. She's wearing a red tube top and a silver miniskirt. Posters hang on the wall behind her saying, "Reduce, reuse, recycle," the "Hang in there, kitten," and a diagram of a cartoon girl that illustrates proper skirt length and notes, "All hair colors must come directly from God." There's also a flyer for Modesty Club on which someone has drawn a vulva. Less is more. We fast through lunch and pocket pills at recess. Gold letters on our gym class asses crown us each a princess. School nuns scold, so we dig little graves in our minds and they fill them with etiquette. Bet they'll better us yet. In church, our voices rise, a sour choir of spit and pride. We stir the nuns' words in our mouths till they curdle. Less is more. At home, our mean mothers pour suave into Avon bottles, stacking dimes as we lie like strips of jerky on our roofs. We tan, we turn, we cure ourselves and wonder, how far down our throats can these new woman hands go? Together we trace rows of looping red X's and O's into our arms with paring knives. We carve our skin to the bone, becoming instruments of less. But we make it up in excess. Rhinestone eyelids, 2-inch acrylics, hair frosted in 3 tones. Each hotbox ride with garage boys is a fantasy of proving the nuns right. We see the road stop like a cartoon cliff, and we're driving on air till someone looks down and we drop, and that's all we've wanted. To hell with other kids' futures, our parents tired rising above. A new high, the long whistle of wind like a lullaby against the slicked reeds of these whittled bodies as we fall glittering to the bottom.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 526 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I speak with my friend, the poet Rochelle Hurt, about her wonderful new book, The J-Girls, a reality show. So how's your week been, everybody? I have a cold, which is one reason why this episode is running a little bit late this week. Not COVID, but still, the cold malingers. I'd like to congratulate my friend Rachel Coleman for being the current resident of the CareRec Project of Orlando.
Just a few hours after I record this intro, there'll be a potluck welcome dinner for her, which I won't be attending with my cold. So for a month, I've decided to subscribe to HBO Max and gobble up some of the content they have over there, binging on the things I'm kind of worried about missing out on. So let's see, I've watched Peacemaker, which is uneven but demented enough to hold my attention. The Many Saints of Newark, the Sopranos prequel, and I can't tell if it actually tells a story or if it's just a pastiche of visions of Sopranos' past, but it wasn't bad, whatever it was. I watched all 2 hours and 15 minutes of The Batman. Now, I've comically reviewed this film before seeing it, saying it's too damn long, and I may have been wrong. Oh, they probably should have shaved 5 to 10 minutes off, but this really counts as like a epic of Gotham, and while I certainly hope, as a series, they're not going to average 3 hours per film, The Batman was the rare case where such a length actually kind of mostly worked. I saw Matrix Resurrections, or maybe just one Resurrection, and I think it might be the best Matrix movie. I mean, if the first Matrix movie were the only Matrix movie, that would be the best one. But the new one was pretty smart, and didn't just sit on my head and crush it. I watched all of the episodes of Autopsy HBO Max has available. I'm not sure if not all of them are available, and frankly, I don't understand why. In competing in these streaming wars, HBO doesn't have more content available, considering their huge catalog. But hearing Dr. Baden tell his stories of the dead is pretty addictive. Less trashy than Forensic Files, but maybe not by a lot. And I'm making my way through Lovecraft Country, which I'm not liking nearly as much as I had hoped. Lots to love in Lovecraft Country, but the story, I think, is deliberately frustrating. Thus concludes my reviews of what I've been binging over at HBO Max. I think I've got another 2 weeks to try and finish out Lovecraft Country. All right, dear listeners, let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today is Rochelle Hurt, who is a poet. She has 3 books of poetry out. The Rusted City, which is a novel in poems, a collection called In Which I Play the Runaway, and her latest book is The J Girls, which is a reality show. Welcome to the show, Rochelle.
Thank you, John.
So one question I like to ask poets is, how the hell did you become a poet? Because normally, by the time we get through high school, poetry has been ruined for us as human beings or as Americans, and normally something has to happen after that. So what's the story?
Yeah, well, I actually started college. I wasn't into poetry before I went to college. And I started college as a painting major and decided to switch to the ever more practical poetry. I just happened to take a poetry workshop and I started reading Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath, who I think are the gateway drugs for a lot of poets. And I guess the rest was history. I just really enjoyed being able to play with language. Painting felt like a lot of pressure to get the finished product right. And with poetry, it felt like I could really just play around with words.
That if you're messy, you still might know what you're doing.
Yeah, I felt more comfortable making a mess with language.
So who taught the workshop?
Kathy Fagan, a poet at Ohio State who mentored me a little bit as an undergrad and is a fantastic poet herself.
So who do you like more, Sylvia Plath or Anne Sexton?
That's tough because they're actually very different. A lot of people group them together because they're the suicide girls, but their poetry, I think, is very different. I think Sexton's a little more cheeky than Plath. So I've been maybe on the Sexton side of things these days, I guess.
And I think, you know, she's a little more formal at times. And like a Plath poem will be brilliant, but I kind of have a sense of where Plath is going to go.
Hmm.
Which is not a knock against Sylvia Plath, but Anne Sexton, I have no idea where the poems are going to go.
Yeah, yeah, she's got some lines that come out of left field, which I appreciate sometimes.
So, though I have to confess, for me, when I started to learn how to love poetry in college, Sylvia Plath was a gateway drug for me. And so I went through a Plath phase, and I'm still not out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Sexton and Plath you know, I'm not actively reading them anymore like I was in college, but they're like my comfort books, you know. I don't often turn to poetry for comfort. I'm usually looking for something different in poetry, something shocking, stimulating, something that makes me slightly uncomfortable or confused at first. But I think, oddly, Plath and Sexton are kind of a comfort to me now because they meant so much to me long ago.
So one thing that happens in your books is there's definitely either, well, there's a gimmick or a theme that is dominant so that, you know, each of your books feels like, yeah, this is definitely a poetry collection, not simply a sampling of good poems that you've written, but that are definitely imagined in a very specific context for a very specific project. So why do you make it so hard on yourself?
I think I get easily bored. I like to make sure that my poems are linked through something more than just topic or voice. If I can kind of build a world and figure out how to fit the poems into that world and then continue building that world through more poems, it keeps me writing, for one. If I know that I have a world to kind of enter into to write my poems, I'll keep writing and I will produce a book. Whereas if I'm writing one-offs, there's nothing to kind of pull me back.
So you're a first-rated novelist, or maybe a successful novelist.
Maybe I'm a novelist who's obsessed with language.
A novelist who doesn't need to just crank out all those many pages.
Yeah, you know, why do you have to explain everything?
So the J-Girls is a really interesting project, and it's this kind of theatrical reality TV show that I imagine in my head. And, you know, there are stage directions, and, you know, I wonder, as you're, well, one, how do you even begin a project like this? Like, where does that idea come from? Writing in poetry in personas is fairly common practice and a great way to get out of our own heads. But I think you've taken that idea that many people would use for a poem or two and generated a whole book out of it. And also, I don't know, thinking about old videos of reality shows seems to be the least poetic thing I think I can imagine as a product. So there's kind of a perverse project in that. So can you talk a little bit about how your latest poetry collection started and when you realized that this is the conceptual way that you've thought of putting multiple poems together?
Yeah, a lot of these poems actually did start as one-offs. I wasn't thinking about multiple characters, but I did feel that I was writing in this like undefined teenage girl type of persona. And then I wrote this piece, which is in the book now, it's the like opening credits. I wasn't originally thinking of this piece as connected to the one-off persona poems, but it was a piece about these neighborhood girls who just like kind of rule the neighborhood. And it's like this teenage girl gang.
Juvenile delinquents.
Yeah, juvenile delinquents. And they all have J names. Because growing up in the 90s, like everybody had a J name, you know, Jennifer, Jessica, Jackie. So I sort of went off that piece and said, wait a minute, what if these persona poems are actually five different girls and these are the J girls that I wrote about in this other piece? So once I put those together, then the poems kept coming and I had multiple voices to write in. It wasn't until much later when I had most of the poems in the book that I started thinking about performance and video. I was in my PhD program when I was writing this book and taking theory courses, which a lot of the poets hated. I loved it, and specifically loved gender and queer theory, and a lot of that had to do with performance. I was very interested in the way that someone could control their own image through performance, and someone could sort of use a stereotype that's been pinned on them and turn it around through satire. And so I thought, okay, that is actually what some of these girls are doing. So what if this was a reality show that they're making with these VHS tapes, which of course feels very 90s as well.
Kind of found footage, although I also have to imagine, like, okay, who's putting this together?
Yeah, they're enterprising. They're like not sophisticated in some ways, but they're enterprising enough to say, okay, let's make a reality show about ourselves using their home camcorders.
And I'm fascinated that, you know, they're personas for you as the writer, but they're also becoming personas for themselves as they understand they're being sexualized. And so rather than simply be passive victims of, I don't know, the male gaze or worse, that they are participating sometimes in their own degradation, sometimes just to have a sense of agency, but also to not simply be children because they can't just be kids just because some adult says, no, you have to stay a kid until a certain point. Like, that's not the way adolescence works.
Yeah, and there are, I think, especially for, let's say, a working class teenager growing up in a small Rust Belt town in the 90s, which would be the characters in this book and me when I was a teenager, for that person, there isn't a lot available to them as means of agency. So one of the things that they could do is perform for a camera because, you know, if somebody says, okay, here's what you're good for being looked at, you're good for being sexualized, you're good for performing the role of girl, then that's one way for them to say, okay, well, that's what I've got to work with, so I'm going to work with it and kind of try and turn it around and take control over my own body, my own image.
So I remember probably around that time, Britney Spears was big.
Yeah.
And influenced a lot of very young girls to dress up like hookers and then go to the mall where men would like stare at them because there was a lot to stare at. And there was this like wonderful cognitive dissonance where they're like, ooh, men are pervs. And it's like, I could see cleavage. I could see your butt. Like, and, you know, I'm a civilized adult who could go, okay, that was 2 seconds of looking and they're children and I am no longer looking. But it took a while, I think, for that to get sorted out at that particular time in popular culture. So your characters are more interesting
than Britney. Britney's pretty interesting.
I disagree, but I don't want to be yet another man or person piling on her for her, you know, she's had a rough decade. Let's put it that way. And I don't begrudge her any success or freedom or anything like that. But I think of a couple of things like the David Bowie line, they're quite aware of what they're going through. I'm not sure the J-Girls know what they're going through 100%. And partly it's trial by fire, trial and error and experimenting. But they are quite aware that a lot of the attention they're generating is through their performance of female sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And like sometimes they suffer for it and sometimes it makes them triumphant, which is more or less how life works.
Yeah.
But what I love about this is it feels like an exploitation movie, like a good one. You know, like there are plenty of exploitation, you're like, but, you know, okay, we're going to examine the social problem and we're going to lavish attention on bad behavior. And like most exploitation movies don't actually reward you for going down that road of exploration because stuff like that tends to be really shallow, but partly because there are numerous girls and there are subplots and also the very playful language that often appears. The metaphors and the turns of phrase are just righteous fun while exploring this sometimes salacious content.
Yeah. Well, that was part of my hope, was that I could explore hellacious content, because I think being a teenage girl is hellacious in many ways, but explore it while having fun. I wanted there to be a lot of joy in this book, and that's part of their gaining agency, is learning how to just kind of have fun and revel in their own pleasure. I think, you know, you mentioned them not being 100% aware of what they're going through, and I think that's true, especially at the beginning. I tried to create an arc where they start out a little less aware, as one does, and then bad things start to happen, and they become a little more aware. Toward the middle of the book, there's this poem called Pluralizing, and it's in this section where a lot of the poems start to use the collective voice a lot more. And that was intentional because I think that there's a lot of power to be gained once they start understanding that they are going through something and they're going through it together, and that maybe a way to push back against it is to kind of team up and support each other and pay attention to each other more than boys, for example.
Because the boys are dangerous.
The boys often are dangerous.
So the reader has to imagine this video experience, this visual experience happening. And I wonder, as you were conceiving of this, was part of the idea to have it only be a book? Like this Coney Island of the mind where it's like, no, like this is a reality show, but it's only going to happen in your mind. Or were you thinking maybe would this work as an actual video presentation?
I would love to produce some kind of video take on the book. I think it's definitely written, even though it's performance, it's, you know, very sonic. It's still written for the page and it's designed to be a book. But of course it lends itself, because of the stage directions and everything, to video. I would absolutely love to put on some kind of stage play or short film or something that featured the J-Girls. I just personally don't have the resources or know-how to do those things.
Oh, well, we'll have to work on that.
Yeah.
So is part of the reason that you went to writing these poems, these persona poems, is a desire not to be identified as the speaker of poems for a bit?
I mean, that's always why I go to persona. How do I write something that I don't want to write as myself or that I'm afraid to write as myself? And sometimes I don't realize that's why I'm even using a persona, but usually it starts to come out in the process and I think, oh, okay, that's why I was gravitating toward this persona, because I said all these things that I can't say as myself. And I think there's
you
also...
You as a nice civilized person.
As a nice civilized, as a professor, yes. But then, you know, there's also the sense that each one of these girls, they're individuals, but in the book, I know that they do merge into this kind of group, this block. And I think that's also partly because I was thinking about the different versions of myself that I've gone through. And the process of coming of age, I think, cycles you through all these different selves. And you go mm-hmm. through some experience and you learn something from it and you adjust the way that you present yourself based on what you want people to think or something that you've learned. And so I also wanted the book to capture the different selves that I've been, you know, before I became the self I am now.
Well, and that's part of getting other people to recognize us is living a persona, like simplifying who we are enough so that people go, oh, I recognize what you're doing there. There was a certain point in my early adulthood when I figured, well, I think this actually, as a senior in high school, I started wearing dress shirts and ties, and people thought I was a teacher, and it really confused people, but I could get away with a whole lot more wearing, instead of the heavy metal t-shirts, wearing the dress shirts. Yeah, I think once I started grad school, like I went to, yeah, I just stopped wearing t-shirts and I can get away with so much more.
Yeah.
It's so rewarding.
You mentioned a few minutes ago something about the reality TV not being necessarily what one thinks of when encountering poetry. And that was, I think, part of my motivation was entering grad school and feeling that some of my experiences as a teen did not match up with my peers in my graduate programs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once in a while I would tell a story about something that happened when I was a teenager that I thought was kind of funny in how maybe trashy it was in some ways, or how like comically Springer-like it was, Jerry Springer. And the reactions I got were like silence or, oh, I'm so sorry.
Are you okay?
Yeah. And I was like, no, I'm telling you because it's funny. Like, it's funny, right? So yeah, encountering that like friction between who I was supposed to become as a person with degrees and accomplishments and who I had been in the past, it made me think, okay, I need to write about this. This is something that maybe a lot of these literary poets don't want to read about, or they think they don't want to read about, is reality TV and trashy behavior, but it's absolutely a part of life. It was a part of my life, so I'm going to write about it.
And this construction of the reality show presented as not a radio play, because there are these visual descriptions of what's in the scene sometimes, but as this sort of theatrical production, gives it a sophistication that an academic will find difficult to dismiss, even if they think, like, you look at the cover and you're like, all right, so there's clearly a girl or woman is displaying herself. All right, this feels a little... But the overall conception is like, okay, but you also have to think of Eugene O'Neill when you enter this book in order to, you know, read it and process it. And I just love that. I love finding ways to let more reality into poetry than the gatekeepers would normally want, even if they would never, ever admit they have an interest in closing the gates on certain subjects or certain poets from certain backgrounds. Yeah. I think the default mode is an uncomfortable level of civility to me.
Yeah, and there's, you know, nobody likes to admit their bias. A lot of people haven't addressed their own bias. They don't know that they have it. They think they don't have it, but it is there. And I think there is a bias against material that's not like traditional capital P poetry. You know, it's not nature poetry. It's not philosophical. It's not trying to make grand statements about all of humanity. It's zeroing in on a specific experience and an experience that belongs to a group of people who are often dismissed, young girls. And these young girls maybe even more so because they're not particularly sophisticated.
From Godville, Ohio.
From Godville, Ohio, yeah.
Is that a real place?
No, that is fictional.
Okay.
Yeah. My goal with the Godville, there's so much wordplay in here that I feel I've done to amuse myself and just hope that it comes across.
G-A-U-D-V-I-L-L-E. Yeah. I mean, it sounds both made up and also plausible.
Yeah. Well, there's so many weird town names, especially in Ohio. So Godville's certainly plausible.
And so they live in this small town on an industrial decline, I imagine.
Yeah. Most of my books, well, I guess all of them technically, feature the Rust Belt in one way or another, because that's where I grew up. And it had a huge impact on how I view the world. I think the Rust Belt is this place that a lot of people dismiss and look down on, but everyone sort of understands that it's important for some reason, historically, politically. But if you're not from there, I think it's often difficult to understand the nuances of a Rust Belt city. And so even though this book isn't very place-based, I did want the setting to still be connected to the Rust Belt and have this kind of outdated, unsophisticated vibe.
Yeah, I grew up in like blue-collar neighborhoods, in a blue-collar family in South Florida. But in South Florida, everything's always changing. And there was this sense of, I don't have to be blue-collar when I grow up. And there are so many opportunities and possibilities. Of course, Florida is filled with Floridians, and like there are plenty of things maybe to not necessarily celebrate, but the idea that there was no future, like that was not a thing in South Florida, or at least not where I was growing up. But I imagine if the major industries are gone and there isn't a ready replacement, that it can really affect the outlook of people. And so, you know, you have to behave like a good person so that when in your 20s, like what will happen exactly?
Well, I think that depends on your family and your neighborhood and whoever else is influencing you. But I know in my family, education was stressed a lot as a means of doing better than the last generation. And part of that implicitly was making it out of the Rust Belt. You know, I don't want to make it sound like people like my parents or my grandparents were like, oh, you got to get out of here, because that wasn't the case. And there are a lot of really great things about the town where I grew up. I dedicated my first book to it, so I just want to make that clear. Youngstown, I love you. But yeah, there was this kind of like understanding that if you were going to get ahead, it probably wasn't going to be in that town.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. Doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase, at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
Hi, this is John Waters, and you're listening to The Drunken Odyssey. Keep on listening, or I'll have you killed.
Rochelle, would you read us a poem?
Sure. This one is a monologue from another character named Joelle. And Joelle is in a school restroom wearing a plaid uniform skirt and a white polo shirt. And she's standing in front of the sink with her back to the mirror. This is called Cunts in the Girls' Room. We rule this muggy vestibule of ringed hands cupped under faucets and caked wet cheeks. Excess is catechism in the room that drinks the runoff of girls made from too much. Cunts who push our luck with wobbly locks we trust to keep our splitting bodies hidden while we kiss and puke and cry and scratch our names into the flaking paint. Neglected bins spit towels and blood-soaked tampons on the tile, while we tow around and spritz our necks vanilla to cloak the smoke or bile. We blow the bell and lipstick stall. We all would kill for another minute here alone, to study our extra selves in the sunless mirror, to find in our faces just one thing worthy.
So before the book has even come out, you've had at least one complaint.
Yes.
Can yes. You tell me about that story?
Yeah, it's kind of surprising because poetry is just doesn't usually reach a broad audience unless you're a really famous poet. And I think this person found me through like a Facebook event for the launch or something. We had mutual friends. And this person sent me a message kind of out of the blue asking why I wrote the book. Was it based on personal experience? Was it centered
on... Oh, that's a foul. That's not a question you're allowed to ask.
Well, I mean, that alone didn't bother me. But then the second part of it was a little more pointed. They said something like, do you care that the immoral behavior in the book is being glorified? Do you care that you're tearing at the fabric of good society? And I just actually directed the person to an interview, and I said, your questions can be answered here in this interview I did, because I didn't want to engage further than that. But it did make me appreciate my book cover, which you mentioned earlier, so I'll describe it. It's an illustration of a girl's behind, and she's wearing jeans that have like split down the middle at the seam, and so a little bit of her ass is showing through, and she's wearing a thong under it, and that's the cover. And the way that they said tearing at the fabric of good society, I thought, oh yeah, that is exactly what I'm doing.
It's a little on the nose.
Thank you for the metaphor. Hadn't really thought about the cover that way, but yes, perfect.
And the cover is both salacious and cute. Like, the colors really... Like, if this was a photograph, it'd be like, I like it, but I don't know if I should like it. I feel bad about liking it. But the colors make it more cute and a little abstract.
Yeah.
Not a lot abstract, but a little abstract in it.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be straight up pornographic or anything. I think it represents the book in that way. You know, there's something kind of bubblegum about it, even as it's salacious. And there's this question of, at least in my mind, when I first saw the artwork, which I asked to use from this great artist named Ani Jin. When I first saw it, I thought, is it a performance? Is it like a cheeky, like, hey, look at this? Or is it actually that she just split her pants? And, you know, like accidentally. And either way, I love it because I love the idea that, you know, if you accidentally split your pants down the middle, you could just turn it into a cheeky performance.
Well, if you're wearing a thong, part of it, I meant to do that.
Like, yeah.
That answer kind of works. So I realize that there's a separate interview where you discuss this, but why are you okay with destroying the fabric of society?
Yeah, I guess I don't see it necessarily as just destroying the fabric of good society, as this person put it. Maybe potentially destroying the fabric of patriarchal society or conservative society.
I almost want to say good taste, except it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Also, I'm okay with destroying conceptions of what is and isn't good taste. I'm cool with that. I think that there's a double bind placed on women and girls where it's like you're supposed to be sexy and look good. You're a thing to be looked at. And yet, if you're too sexy, then it's slutty and it's not acceptable. And when you're a teenage girl, I think you feel that double bind really strongly. So a lot of the kind of showing off in the book, showing off sexuality, rebelling against dress codes, it's a response to that double bind.
It's really exciting that someone thinks you can harm the fabric of good society with a book of poetry.
I was flattered, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure I can, but, you know, if it's contributing at all, then great.
I mean, is the fear what young girls are going to find this book and then think, oh, like, yes, there are trashy versions of ourselves that we could go celebrate, which might not be the worst thing in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think the mindset is sort of like the abstinence-only mindset and the don't say gay bill. Like, if we don't talk about it, they won't know it's there, so they won't do it, which is a really flawed way of thinking.
Yeah, there's lots of data, but the data doesn't matter provided you never look at the data.
Right. Right.
And I think I have a deep and abiding affection for outlaw literature. Not that this quite rises to that level, although, I don't know, like addressing sexuality and teenage girls, like, okay, maybe.
They can certainly be outlaws.
But the idea that these are poetic subjects, and at your age, you're not a teenager. I imagine it was fun just trying to get back, like trying to remember what it actually felt like to live in a teenage body and deal with a teenage world. So I think most teenagers don't write good poetry. And if we write good poetry about being a teenager in retrospect, there's something missing in the chaos of what it felt like to be a teenager.
Something missing in the chaos, like it doesn't seem as realistic, or?
It doesn't seem as volatile or as surprising. Like, the confusion I felt as a teenager, like, I'll never have that confusion again. Like, and, like, plenty of things confuse me, but not, like, the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the poems in this book are not poems that I could have written as a teenager at all. So, of course, there's a little more of an adult perspective that's like seeping into the teenage voices. But I think that that's what I hope makes them interesting as poems that both inhabit the teenage body and comment on it from an adult perspective. You know, once I started processing a lot of my adolescence, by the time that I had processed enough to be able to write about it, I was almost 30. So, yeah, it feels a little weird to be now 37 and reading and promoting this book about teenage girls, but it does take a lot of time.
And I think it's probably underrepresented. Like, it is the time when the worst poetry usually gets written in a person's life. For me, it happened a little bit later. My first great humanitarian act was to stop writing poetry. And then I picked it up much later when I was teaching students how to write poetry, and I felt like I was obligated then to write poetry even if it was bad, because I had to show my students that I was willing to do what I was asking them to do.
Yeah. Y'all often write bad poems like on the spot for my students when I'm trying to give them examples of metaphors, partly because it's really hard to come up with good things on the spot, but I think that vulnerability is useful.
Well, and the spirit of discovery in poetry, I mean, for me, it's a truism about writing. You have to let it be bad. Like, you don't have to publish it, but you have to let it be bad. That is a risk you have to take if you're going to write much.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that was part of this project, and even the new project that I'm working on now is like getting out of this mindset of, okay, is this good? Am I producing a good publishable product? And instead just going with what is really fun and exciting and worrying about the fact, kind of going back, and, you know, that's what revision is for. But in the moment of the creative act, I think it's been really helpful for me to just push the question of, is this publishable and is this good, completely out of the way.
You said the word fun, which we seldom hear in discussions of poetry.
Oh, that's sad. Yeah.
I don't think I'm wrong. Am I wrong?
Maybe you're right. Yeah. I feel like we're maybe hearing it more, a little more often. I hear the word fun come up in discussions of poetry. But yeah, I think a lot of people have this sense that poetry needs to be only serious and serious, you know, in a way that's not fun. But I had a lot of fun writing these poems. I love puns. I love innuendo. And I love teen drama. So I was like, let's put it all in. Let's just have the most fun.
So one of the things I thought about was this very old, well, old now, reality show. Because there weren't many teenage reality shows, because that's kind of unethical.
Yes.
But the Disney Channel had one for summer camp. It was a summer camp reality show called Bug Juice. And I just remember it was so fascinating. And again, partly it's because it's like unfiltered teenage behavior. And it's like, I have to struggle to even remember what it felt like. Not just what happened, but what it felt like when things happened. And so there were two couples, and the two girls decided to play a wonderful practical joke on their boyfriends. They were going to break up with them for pretend and then go, no, we were just kidding, like an hour later. And the homicidal looks on these two boys when they were broken up with really showed me how dangerous being a teenager is and how dangerous men are, because frankly, like, grown men don't necessarily behave better than that. But they were just like, the girls thought, oh, this will be a fun thing to try or do. And it's like, in the adult world, people die that way.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that.
Like, the looks on the boys were scary.
Yeah. There's that quote from, I think it's Margaret Atwood. I really don't want to be the person who misattributes quotes, but I'm pretty sure it's Margaret Atwood has said, men are afraid that women will laugh at them and women are afraid that men will kill them. And there's the difference.
Yeah. So let's talk about In Which I Play the Runway.
Sure.
So I imagine at a certain point you figure out that there's a thing happening in poems speaking to each other, and then you're like, I've got a collection. All right, so what needs to be added to this collection? But like, what's the fun in the early stages of a project like that?
Well, In Which I Play the Runaway is a little different from The J-Girls and The Rusted City in that it's a little bit less of a concept book. There's a little bit less of a narrative. But, of course, the poems are really closely connected through theme. And there's a couple different series throughout the book. I love working in series. And I realized that I had a growing number of poems about towns with odd names. Yeah, I would find these towns and just become really interested in like the figurative potential of the names. So, for example, I haven't opened that book in a while, but I think there's a town called I'm Alone, Wisconsin. It's one word, I'm Alone. A town called Nightmute, Alaska. A town called Hurt, Virginia, which of course has special significance for me. So a lot of, Accident, Maryland was another great one. So a lot of these towns had these odd names, and it got me thinking about small towns and the act of and the desire to leave them. So a lot of the book, once I realized that I had so many poems about these odd towns with these odd metaphorical names, I realized that the book was really about that feeling of being trapped in a place, of feeling rooted to a place, and yet wanting badly to leave that place or to leave the domestic situation that you're in that place. So then the book became centered around those weird towns.
And often as locations where, like trying to get out, or places where you are after you got out, and it's like, okay, but this next place isn't the solution.
Yeah, that's the arc in that book, was coming to the realization that, you know, there's no place like home in more ways than one. You know, like you can leave a place and you can leave a situation, but you're still stuck with yourself. I think a big part of that book was coming to terms with the idea that if I try to avoid certain patterns that my parents went through, or my grandparents, or people in my town, that didn't necessarily guarantee that I was going to be free of any kind of mental anguish. Not to make it sound like too much fun.
Well, that is, you know, there's such a parental trap. Like, okay, like we're going to raise our kids better than our parents. And it's like, well, how good exactly is that going to be?
Yeah.
So you teach, and I think students, when they enter a poetry classroom and a poetry workshop, that there might be that academic expectation of, okay, like capital P poetry. And I'm sure when it comes to like sharing work with your students, that there's so much great work for them to read. But I also wonder, do you make the classroom fun, and how do you try and encourage students to sort of cross more lines as poets?
Yeah, I often hear from students that they came into my class thinking that they weren't going to like it because they never liked poetry. But the books that we read, I think, show them that poetry can be fun, poetry can be playful, poetry can be raunchy and rebellious, and they don't think of poetry that way coming in. So I try to give them texts that show them that poetry can really do a lot of things that they weren't expecting. And we do a lot of exercises that encourage them to kind of like break the rules. I like starting class with the idea that there are no rules, or that every rule can be broken if you do it well. And I think they really appreciate that because they've just had canonical poetry in high school. I love a Shakespeare sonnet as much as an Anne Sexton poem or a contemporary poem. But the way that it's taught in high school often doesn't allow room for any joy.
Well, I once did a reconnaissance mission to an education store, which it feels weird that that's a thing, that there's an education store, but it's a store just for teachers, and they had the teacher's guides to different books. And I just felt like this is where literature dies because it had a very programmatic sense of the language with which you could talk about literature. Mm. And they had Freytag's, you know, for novels, they had the Freytag pyramid. Even though that was never intended for novels, that was for drama.
Mm.
And we've just assumed that it will work for novels when, in fact, no, like the loose and baggy, monster called the novel, because you could sort of, if you draw the pyramid and go, okay, does this stuff happen in the novel? If you try and draw like the plot of a novel, like an EKG, saying, okay, no, don't just fill in the pyramid, but draw it the way it actually feels, which I did that with, I had a bunch of students do the portrait of Dorian Gray, and that was the picture of Dorian Gray. It was hysterical. Some of them were like, well, it's really, really boring, so it's a flat line, and then it got really boring, and then it just kind of stopped. And other students were like, it kind of jumps, but it's not this, like, that's a very, like, long view, and it was really not meant for the novel format, because the novel can be really episodic, which isn't necessarily this roller coaster ride. And so plenty of teachers were going into classrooms. I don't even know if literature is taught anymore in high school, but back in the day, the teachers had their language that they would use from these teachers' manuals. And if it wasn't in the manual, I think they would just tend to shut down discussion, because what was in the manual was safe, and who knows what the right answers are if you start asking like weird questions about Hamlet.
Yeah.
which it's just really easy to go have a freewheeling, roaming conversation about Hamlet that isn't going to talk about Aristotle or the normal things that you would say, oh, it's a tragedy, and we can look, just check all the boxes for what a tragedy does, and this is a tragedy. Sure. It also has words. Should we make a box for that? It has words. Whereas if you go, why is it taking Hamlet so long to do this thing? Or how sexually attracted is he to his mom? Or did he and Ophelia have sex?
And those are the questions that Shakespeare would have wanted, I think, discussed. I had no interest in Shakespeare at all until I took a college course. And then one of my professors, who was a really great professor, started pointing out all of the, I can't remember which play it was, but all of the sexual innuendo and the puns on genitalia. And I was like sitting way in the back of the class, kind of not paying much attention. And then he started talking about how no thing was code for like, doesn't have a penis, is castrated or something. And I was like, I perked up. I was like, wait a minute.
That's a perfect thought to lie between a woman's legs.
I was like, this just got more interesting. Let me pay attention. And I think that, you know, that is the stuff that they want to hear about. Who doesn't? So, yeah, I try to make it. I don't teach Shakespeare, but the contemporary stuff I teach and the exercises I give, I try to make it fun and maybe even slightly shocking in some ways for them, because that makes them sit up and pay attention.
And at least, yeah, no one sleeps.
Yes. Yeah. No, I have not had a sleeping student in my classroom since I taught freshman composition. There may have been one or two then, but I don't teach that anymore.
And it's hard to squeeze poetry sometimes into a comp class.
Yeah.
So who are some of your favorite poets today? And let me rephrase that question, because I realize I just threw a bomb over there. Excluding your personal friends.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to shelve that, because otherwise we will be here too long. But, you know, among poets who aren't your friends, like what are the poets who are doing things that excite you?
Yeah, Anne Carson is my favorite writer. She's a poet, but she's also a prose writer. She writes in every genre and everything between genres. Her work is just uncategorizable and weird, and that's why I love it. Anne Carson, I don't know that I have, other than Anne Carson, I don't know that I have like a stable favorite poet, but I have poets that I'm really interested in right now. One of those is a poet named Lo Kwa Man, who uses this really kind of hyper language, hyper musical, almost like this hyped up way of talking, but that still sounds very beautiful in her poetry. So I'm really into her work at the moment. Also this poet named Lynn Melnick. Just read one of her books called Landscape with Sex and Violence. Yeah. This is the kind of stuff I give my students. I'm like, here, poetry can do more. She just takes on rape culture and gender bias in ways that I think a lot of poets are afraid to. She's so direct and so smart.
All right. And anyone else?
This is such a hard question, because I'm like, I'm going to get home and be like, I forgot to mention so-and-so.
Well, I tried to take the burden off by just saying, first of all, we're ruling out people you personally know.
People I personally know. Well, I just read, actually, I'm currently reading Natalie Diaz. She has two books. And the second one is the one I'm reading now, called Postcolonial Love Poem. And they're queer love poems that kind of take on the difficult connections between social and political issues and personal relationships and how you kind of merge and navigate those things. Natalie Diaz is a pretty famous poet, so I don't really need to sell her, but really loving post-colonial love poem at the moment.
Well, I love expanding my knowledge of poetry and like what's good out there. And unfortunately, my concept of like the good new poetry is the poets who are pitched to appear on my show, which isn't the worst way. And I do keep discovering like wonderful new poets or wonderful poets whose work is new to me. But I'm just always curious, like, what am I missing out on? So thank you for that.
Sure.
As a teacher, I think I love and I hate teaching. If I just can not think about how much grading I have to do and think about the surprises my students bring to me with the work that they're doing, sometimes that makes me really hungry to do more of my own work, where that sense of discovery, it's the thing I think I'm most addicted to as a writer. And you really can't do that wanting to write or thinking about writing, but actually getting the words down on the page. I've had the experience where sometimes I go to continue a project and I'm like, oh, I thought I wrote more. And it's because my brain just thought of something but didn't actually get it written down. What are your experiences as a teacher in terms of, I don't know, things your students might teach you or inspire you?
Yeah, I mean, my students are often surprising in good ways and bad ways. I think that a lot of times when I have students coming into the classroom who are coming from other disciplines, you know, they're art majors or they're film majors, or, you know, once in a while we'll get something really unexpected like microbiology major, then they start writing about those topics in their poems and it kind of sparks my interest and I'll look something up that they wrote about or that they mentioned in class and, you know, go down this like Wikipedia wormhole that gets me interested in the topic. And I'm doing that right now with my new book project, which is about art, specifically art by women. And I don't know that any particular student got me into this, but I noticed that I had a lot of students who were coming to poetry from the arts, from visual art. And I myself started college in visual art. So I thought, okay, I'm going to return to this because it's something that feels like I started to research it and I started to situate myself in the art world and then kind of left that for poetry. So how do I come back to that and merge the two? So now I'm spending a whole lot of time reading and researching art as a way to get into my new project.
I find until I have a hook, it's hard to get a long-term project going. I have to figure out what gimmick, and I mean gimmick in the most positive sense, like what gimmick is going to kind of get this thing rolling. So it sounds like you maybe work the same way.
Yes. Yeah. And I really need that, I think, to keep going. I need a long-term project to have the sense that I'm going to actually continue writing until I have a book.
Okay. Well, I'm going to advocate that you give your orphans a home and that some of these one-off poems maybe deserve their own collection. But I also wholeheartedly endorse your writing books of poems that really, really cohere as a solid volume as well.
Okay. Well, thanks. Yeah, I have some orphans that, you know, sometimes the orphans get incorporated into a world or into a project, but I do have a lot of orphans that just haven't found a place yet. I started writing list poems for a while and I thought, well, maybe I could do a whole book of list poems, and quickly abandon that altogether. So I have some list orphans.
All right. Can you take us out with a poem?
Sure. Any requests?
I was thinking maybe one of the older books.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'll read one of those weird town poems from in which I play the runaway. All right, I'll read Self-Portrait in Hurt, Virginia, which is a place I've never been, but I've always thought perhaps I might find an ancestor or two buried there with the last name Hurt, so I still got to go to Hurt, Virginia. Self-Portrait in Hurt, Virginia. I was born a fleck of mill trash bedded in a black hill, a cry stoppered with crabgrass. I lived as a stick in the stuck mud drift of land called Virginia. I was born among a clutter of cats and tongues sloughing a crust of coal spit from their coalbit teeth. I was born an apology. I was born with a gift for gall and grit, late to a woman with hands as slick as her knickers. I was born a breadcrumb in a trail of fathers leading out of our clapboard house. I was patched into a tawdry dress my sister wore for prayers and hollers until it was torn from her hips and a kernel of a baby shook loose. My sister's skin wrapped around his like a noose. "You'll never tell home from hurt," my father said. His kiss was a curse placed on my mother's forehead.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Rochelle Hurt, Chelsea Alice for editing this episode, and of course, our sponsor, Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including The Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect in The Perfect Life, Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, and The Curator of Schlock, written by our curator of schlock, Jeff Schuster. All right, everybody, until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.